We're in the session before lunch, and so we have an invited speaker after the first speaker, and the first speaker is indeed Meg Zellers. Off you go, Meg.
Hello. Thank you, everyone, for being here. I'm going to be talking about, as you see, contrastive structures, topic shifts, and prosody in conversation. And the first thing that I have to warn you is that my background is not actually in conversation analysis. I'm using conversation analysis in combination with what you might call more an experimental phonetics methodology, but I'm hoping to show you today that those two methodologies can be combined fruitfully and that you should be aware of some of the things that this is useful for. So just to give you some quick background on my project, what I'm working on is called Multiple Methods, Approaches to Discourse Topic Structure. And the three basic goals are to investigate the phonetic features of topic organization in conversational speech and in production and perception, although my perception experiments are completely failing at this current time, so we're going to be talking about production data today. And of course, the main challenge here is trying to combine qualitative methodologies such as CA and quantitative methodologies such as the experimental statistical approach that I've been taking before, and doing that in a way that's meaningful for practitioners of both, even more so. And if any of you are familiar with the research network Sound to Sense that finished last year, this project grew out of the research that's being done within the Sound to Sense network. So why approach topic from this point of view? Well, since I'm coming at it from two directions, there's actually relevant insights in both. From an experimental phonetics or phonology point of view, and this is what I did my PhD on, you can look at these phonetic cues to topic structure, and I looked at red speech, as indeed most studies in what I'll call EP do, in production and perception, and you can get pretty consistent phonetic cues to topic. Now, CA, or what we can call the phonetics of talk and interaction, has also looked at topic a little bit, but with relatively less attention than EP, because the focus is on, of course, social action and the relationship of these structures to the action. So topic shift in and of itself isn't necessarily interesting, but rather, what is topic shift doing? But what we do have in common across these two approaches is interest in the global organization of talk or of discourse or of whatever you want to call it, and especially in experimental methodologies, this growing interest in looking at spontaneous speech and recognizing that spontaneous conversational data looks very different from what you get in the lab. Now, why contrast? Well, contrastive constructions, and I'm going to define these following Mann and Thompson 1992 as constructions that have something that's the same, something that's different, and then they're compared with regard to those differences. And we'll see an example in a little bit so that you can be clear on what that means. These were really striking in the data that I was looking at as I was kind of looking for topic changes to work with. And from an EP point of view, prosodic contrast is very well studied in EP. Now, it's not very well functionally defined because, to me, the crucial flaw that these experimental lab approaches have is that they assume functions rather than looking for functions. So just as a caveat, prosodic contrast is well studied but not necessarily well defined. But because you have approaches to contrast in CA and approaches to contrast in EP, it's a good point of contact. You know, there's a way to bring these together and to say, well, what do these two approaches have to say about a phenomenon that's at least recognizably or arguably similar? Now, just to give you, I want to give you a quick overview of topic because it's important to be clear what we're talking about. And again, we're going to see this same distinction here between interest in form and interest in function. So in CA, what you have when you look at work on topic is primarily this concern with function. And you have these two ways of doing topic shift. So one is a disjunctive topic when one topic kind of winds down. And generally, conversational participants agree on this. And then a new topic is launched. This is especially work by Button and Casey looking at topic initial elicitors or topic announcements. That would be a disjunctive topic shift. Whereas on the other hand, you have these stepwise topic shifts that Sachs talks about and later Jefferson, where you don't really have maybe a clear location for the boundary between these two topics, but you kind of start on one thing and gradually as you go along, eventually you're talking about something else. And these are of course much more common. And again, what we see in CA is of course that the interactional function has priority over content. So these topic changes can be doing something else. It's not just that you change topic for the sake of changing topic, but you can change topic because you're unhappy with the current topic, or you can change topic because something that someone has said has touched off a new topic that you want to talk about. Now, in experimental or lab approaches, you're looking at the form of topic shifts, and as I've said at the bottom here, the topic shifts that experimental, the EP looks at are exclusively what we would call disjunctive changes in CA. Because there's no like official definition of a stepwise change that EP would recognize as a topic change, they just haven't been studied as such at all. Now when you get these disjunctive changes, primarily in red texts, or at best you get like semi-spontaneous data, as Richman did with BBC News readers, what you see consistently is pitch reset, larger pitch movements, possibly decreased speech rate at the beginnings of new topics, although that's a bit, in my own research, that was a bit debatable because I found both expanded and compressed speech rate at different locations. But these are consistent across languages, and these are also consistent with what you find at disjunctive boundaries in the CA literature. So I think at least that we can be fairly confident that at disjunctive topic boundaries, we have an idea what's happening prosodically. So the methodology I'm going to talk about today, and this is completely exploratory and in development, and I am open to all comments as to how I'm building this methodology. But what we have basically is a three-part process. And I'll show you how I'm going to apply this three-part process to investigating topic changes with contrastive structures, and specifically the prosody of those topic changes. So the first part of this process is to create a data collection. So just as you would do in any CA study, listening to the data and looking for instances of a given phenomenon. But I'm trying to be especially close in my controls on the syntactic form, because I also want to have a data set that an experimentalist who's used to lab speech, which is literally, 10 different versions of the same sentence, I want to have a data set that someone who's used to that kind of thing can look at and say, okay, these things are definable, or you can see that they're consistent, you can see that they're instances of one thing. That does tend to lead to a very restricted data set, as you'll see later on, but I've tried to be as careful as possible because this is developing the methodology. Once I have that CA collection, then I'm going to use more the kinds of statistical tools that you would see in a lab-based analysis. So what we'll see today are a few things with using just linear models, generalized linear models, and using a k-means cluster analysis. I'm not going to go into detail about the statistics, don't worry, I'll try and show you pictures rather than numbers, because I don't really like seeing all the numbers either. But then once we have the results of the statistical model, instead of just saying, okay, well, this is what it looks like, isn't that nice, then taking those and coming back to CA and say, well, how can we interpret these results, and how can we interpret the variation, and especially with regard to border cases or outliers in the statistical analysis, because in an experimental approach, there's a tendency to kind of throw out outliers and say, well, they don't fit in the model, the participant must have fallen asleep, we're just going to ignore this because we don't know what to do with it. But CA provides a brilliant tool for saying, well, these things are outside of the expected pattern, so why are they outside of the statistical distribution? What can we say about that? Now, the data that I've used for this analysis, it comes from mostly telephone and some face-to-face conversations from a number of different corpora that are all available through TalkBank. So these are freely available on the internet. They are all American English, and they're all two-party conversations at the time when the sequences that I'm looking at occur, although some of them have other participants at different times. I extracted in total 84 tokens of contrastive structures, and as I said, with the contrastive structure, partly the same, partly different. Now they had to show contrast in the syntactic structure, and then optionally they could also have prosodic contrast just impressionistically through listening, and optionally they could lead to a topic change, but neither of those had to be the case. But what we're going to look at today, the analyses are based on a subset of these contrastive structures, and the ones that we're looking at are contrasts that are adjacent to each other. So either they occur immediately next to each other, one turn, so one turn for the first half and one turn for the second half, or they could have an intervening, like an acknowledgement token, yeah or okay, but not a full turn intervening, so it could only be something very small. So to give you an example of this, I hope you can read this. There's four parts that go into the analysis. Now the two crucial things with the, sorry, I'll do this with the mouse so that everyone can see. The two crucial parts of the contrast are what are numbered 2 and 3, okay? So I've called those the antecedent, which is labeled 2, and then the contrastive turn, or the contrast, is 3. And these are the two turns that have the similar syntactic form. Okay, so here, yeah, right, that's one thing actually, and then the other thing is. So you can see that similarity of form. And then to expand the data set and also to just be able to make wider comparisons, I've included more of the sequence. So there's also the turn before the antecedent, which is the pre-turn, and the turn following the contrastive turn, which I've called the post-turn. So you'll hear me refer to these four turn types: the pre-turn, the antecedent, the contrastive turn, and the post-turn. So what you need to know is that they're all these parts of the sequence. The other thing I want to say is that although here you only have one contrastive turn, occasionally there's more than one contrast, and there's an example we'll see later that actually has two. There's an antecedent and then a contrastive turn that launches a new antecedent, and then another contrastive turn, and then the post-turn. So there doesn't have to be just one. So for the phonetic analysis, what I've done here is focused on global prosodic features rather than local prosodic features. And I know that Tracy later on, I think, is going to be talking a little bit more about more local phenomena, looking at pitch contours. But what you find, first of all, is that the local phenomena and the global phenomena don't necessarily depend on each other. So you can have one high pitch peak without that affecting the overall mean pitch of the turn in a meaningful way if you're taking enough measurements. So these two things vary independently. So it's important to note that we're looking at global phenomena right now, not local, because I think that they have different scope of meaning. You know, prosody covers a whole bunch of things, but today I'm talking about pitch and rhythm. So for pitch features, and the pitch measurements are taken in semitones, the relevant things are the mean F0 of the turn, and it's not just the mean F0, but the mean F0 compared to the speaker's mean taken from as much data as I could get for each speaker. And then also the F0 range of the turn, so that's the distance between the highest F0 peak in the turn and the lowest non-final valley. So that's what the measurement of the range is. Then for rhythm features, I measured just average syllable duration, which is, it's a bit tough to take when you've got reduction, but did the best I could. So that's, those measures will just be in seconds. And then I also took the ratio of stressed to unstressed syllables, and stressed syllables were, I identified them impressionistically first and then went back through looking for local amplitude peaks and for pitch movements associated with them. To give you an idea of how those are defined. And then, so that's, if you're familiar with like work by Susan Uman, that stuff she's done where you get different rate, kind of different feelings of speech rate based both on just the segmental or the syllable duration and then the ratio of stressed to unstressed syllables. Those can affect your perception of rate. Okay. And just in all of these, comparing things to the surrounding terms is always really important. In the statistical model, this means that they're treated as what we call repeated measures, and that treats it as coming from a sequence rather than just appearing independently. Now, first thing, looking at prosodic contrast. Now, you can identify prosodic contrast acoustically, but what I found actually is that in terms of the global pitch features, a prosodically contrastive turn isn't any different from a non-prosodically contrastive turn, like within looking within the contrastive turns. So the global pitch features are the same. Now, generally, the prosodically contrastive turn is going to have a local pitch peak, but that doesn't affect the overall global measurements when you compare them. What they do differ in is this stressed syllable ratio. So what you get is, sorry, I keep walking over to one screen, but there are two. What you get is, if there is a prosodic contrast, you have a higher ratio of stressed to unstressed syllables across the whole utterance. And this is the difference isn't very big, but it is statistically significant. And that's consistent with actually a lot of findings that prominence in English is cued better with rhythmic factors than with pitch factors. So that's kind of an interesting finding in and of itself, but it's also nice to see it in this spontaneous and potentially rather messy data. Now, looking at pitch range, now pitch range was, in my own thesis when I was looking at red speech, pitch range was the most important cue to topic shift. It was even more important, actually, than just absolute pitch reset. But what you see here in these contrastive in these contrastive structures, in the contrastive turn, which is this middle case here, there's no difference in the pitch range. So there's, I would expect to see in a topic change an expanded pitch range, and in a non-topic change a compressed pitch range. And these are compared to the previous turn. So do they have a higher or a lower, or a wider or a narrower pitch range than the previous turn? And both of these, the error bars overlap the zero line. So in the contrastive turns, there's no meaningful difference in the size of the pitch range from the antecedent. So there's no variation in pitch range whether or not there's been a topic shift. But if there has been a topic shift in the following turn, so in the post turn, then you do get a slightly expanded pitch range. And if there has not been a topic shift, then you get a compressed pitch range. So this is I'm going to argue that this shows an orientation to a topic shift in essentially a stepwise condition, but because it's stepwise, you don't orient to it in the place where the topic change is initiated in the contrast, but actually following that. Okay. Now, I'm going to have to rush through this because this is a bit complicated, but another thing I've done is taken all of these phonetic measurements and put them into a cluster analysis. And a cluster analysis groups turns together by how similar they are, in this case on the basis of their prosodic features. So turns that are more similar occur in the same cluster, and turns that are less similar occur in different clusters. And so you can see, I won't get into why I chose to use four clusters. But these are the variation in, first of all, in the mean pitch compared to the speaker mean, in the pitch range, and then in the ratio of stressed to unstressed syllables. And I also put average syllable duration into this, but actually it was predictive in the same way as the stressed to unstressed syllables, so it's left out of the final version. And what you find is that, unexpectedly, sometimes antecedents and contrastive turns cluster together, so they have similar global prosodic features. And this is really, really unexpected when you think about prosodic contrast, the whole point of prosodic contrast being to make it sound different. And again, with topic shift, the kind of canonical expectation is that it's going to sound different. But as you'll have guessed from the data we've seen before, there's another explanation for this. And what I think happens is that you see this matching, this prosodic matching, in cases where there's some kind of interactional trouble that has to be dealt with. And when there's no trouble, then the contrastive turn can be upgraded. Okay, I'm going to have to rush through this a bit. So the example here, and I'm sorry, I don't have a sound file, but what you see happening here is E and F are on the phone, and they're discussing F has just had a miscarriage. And so E is saying, you know, you're feeling okay now, how are you? And E's very concerned, but F is kind of, she's trying to play this down. So she's saying, I'm feeling fine, 100%, so she's upgrading this. She's insisting that she's feeling fine, whereas E is using these more downgraded terms, you know, okay, kind of to express concern, and maybe she's not convinced. And in this, these contrastive turns, you'll see there's two contrastive turns down here. F uses this first contrast to achieve a topic change. She concludes saying, "No, I'm doing fine," and then almost immediately, and without waiting for E to give any real kind of supportive acceptance of that, moves right on to, "How are you doing? You didn't end up going to Italy." And so these two turns, since I don't have the sound file, you can't hear this, but all of these, two and all the way through both instances of three, all of these came into the same cluster in the cluster analysis, so their global prosodic features are very similar. And I would argue that the reason they're doing this is it's about potentially F's discomfort with the previous topic, or her not accepting E's proposed interpretation of what's going on, and so F's desire to change the direction of the conversation, but she doesn't want to leave this to chance. She wants to insist that this is happening. So by treating it prosodically the same, she's kind of treating it as if she's not doing anything different, even though she very strongly wants to change the direction of the conversation, and indeed does that without waiting for E to ratify that topic change. So I hope I've made a case for you that these quantitative methods can give a way in to some of this conversational data. So we've been able to note some prosodic patterns in a previously unstudied phenomenon, these stepwise topic shifts. And also, we've identified some potential sites of interactional trouble. But of course, we need CA in order to interpret these, because lab methodology isn't going to recognize something like interactional trouble as a category. The implications here for topic, of course, are that speakers and conversationalists do orient to it. And we can see this even in stepwise changes. They're more common, but we see an orientation to the topic change on the part of the speakers. And they have this recognizable form. So one direction for future research, of course, might be to see if other stepwise changes show this similar form of the pitch movement in the post turn. And just ideas for extending this further and to hopefully express to you why I think it's so important to be bringing CA and EP together. First of all, in CA, we've got this increasing interest in larger bodies of data, data that's large enough that it's too hard to listen to all of it yourself. But of course, if you've got a quantitative method that can identify points of interest like this, then you have a way of getting at that data without having to just, you know, listen to 900 hours of conversation. Also, using cluster analysis or principal component analysis could give you insight into borderline cases. So when you have a collection and you say, well, there's about 100 tokens in my collection, but some of them I'm not sure about, if you can look at those statistically, it might give you insight as to why those cases are borderline, and then you can make an argument for how to deal with those. And then finally, as I've been saying, using some of these quantification methods allows us to compare between what we see in CA and what we see in experimental approaches, and hopefully to be able to then adopt findings from one and apply them to the other, and to make them accessible. And I think that's the most important goal here, is to be able to communicate across different disciplines what we're doing. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Meg. Time for a couple of questions. Yes, Robert Dickel.
One thought that occurs to me is whether it might be interesting to look at the 1980s work on political speeches, which are also massively marked by contrastive structures, and which would be, I think, an interesting intermediate case between the newsreader and the everyday conversation. And I mean, as I recall, it's a very long time since I've read any of it. I mean, essentially, you've got a disjunctive structure, but it's something which is very much being projected for an audience, and you might find the sort of the exaggeration of some of the features that you're interested in there, in ways that, in a sense, might help you to make that movement from here is the heavily scripted environment to here is the everyday conversational environment, and that kind of data is obviously pretty readily accessible. I mean, it's all on YouTube these days.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, you do see even in this data, there's a difference between contrasts that are done by one speaker and planned and contrasts that are done by a second speaker building off the first speaker's term. So that would certainly, within a speech, obviously it's much more planned. So that would be interesting to see. Thank you.
Right, let's move on to the next speaker. Thank you very much.